Chapter 25. Beating the Odds. When school let out for the summer, Jenny packed the kids into the minivan and headed to Boston for a week to visit her sister. I stayed behind to work. That left Marley with no one at home to keep him company and let him out. Of the many little embarrassments old age inflicted on him, the one that seemed to bother him most was the diminished control he had over his bowels. He no longer could go more than a few hours between pit stops. When the urge called, he had to go, and if we were not home to let him out, he had no choice but to go inside. It killed him to do it, and we always knew the second we walked into the house when he had had an accident. Instead of greeting us at the door in his exuberant manner, he would be standing far back in the room, his head hanging nearly to the floor, his tail flat between his legs, the shame radiating off him. We never punished him for it. How could we? He was nearly 13, about as old as labs got. With Jenny and the kids away, I knew I would be putting in long days. This was my chance to stay out after work, wandering around the region and exploring the towns and neighborhoods I was now writing about. I would be away from home 10 to 12 hours a day. There was no question Marley couldn't be alone that long, or even half that long. We decided to board him at the local kennel we used every summer when we went on vacation. The kennel was attached to a large veterinarian practice that offered professional care, if not the most personal service. Each time we went there, it seemed, we saw a different doctor. We never even learned their names. Unlike our beloved Dr. J in Florida, who knew Marley almost as well as we did, and who truly had become a family friend by the time we left. These were strangers, competent strangers, but strangers nonetheless. Marley didn't seem to mind. I dropped him off on a Sunday evening and left my cell phone number with the front desk. That Tuesday morning, I was near Independence Hall in downtown Philadelphia when my cell phone rang. It was yet another veterinarian whose name I had never heard before. "We have an emergency with Marley," she said. Marley's stomach had bloated with food, water, and air, and then, stretched and distended, had flipped over on itself, twisting and trapping its contents. With nowhere for the gas and other contents to escape, his stomach had swelled painfully in a life-threatening condition known as gastric dilatation volvulus. "It almost always required surgery to correct," she said, "and if left untreated could result in death within a few hours." She said she had inserted a tube down his throat and released much of the gas that had built up in his stomach, which relieved the swelling. By manipulating the tube in his stomach, she had worked the twist out of it, or as she put it, unflipped it, and he was now sedated and resting comfortably. "That's a good thing, right?" I asked cautiously. "But only temporary. We got him through the immediate crisis, but once their stomachs twist like that, they almost always will twist again." "Like how almost always?" "I would say he has a 1% chance that it won't flip again," she said. 1%? For God's sakes, I thought. He has better odds of getting into Harvard. 1%? That's it? "I'm sorry. It's very grave." If his stomach did flip again, and she was telling me it was a virtual certainty, we had two choices. The first was to operate on him. She said she would open him up and attach the stomach to the cavity wall with sutures to prevent it from flipping again. "The operation will cost about $2,000, and I have to tell you, it's very invasive. It will be tough going for a dog his age." The recovery would be long and difficult, assuming he made it through the operation at all. Sometimes older dogs like him did not survive the trauma of the surgery, she explained. If he was 4 or 5 years old, I would be saying, by all means, let's operate. But at his age, you have to ask yourself if you really want to put him through that. "What's the second option?" "The second option," she said, hesitating only slightly, "would be putting him to sleep." "Oh." I was having trouble processing it all. 5 minutes ago, I was walking to the Liberty Bell, assuming Marley was happily relaxing in his kennel run. Now I was being asked to decide whether he should live or die. I had never even heard of the condition she described. Only later would I learn that bloat was fairly common in some breeds of dogs, especially those, such as Marley, with deep, barrel chests. Dogs who scarf down their entire meal in a few quick gulps, Marley once again, also seemed to be at higher risk. The vet on the phone acknowledged Marley's excitement around the other dogs in the kennel could have brought on the attack. He had gulped down his food as usual and was panting and salivating heavily, worked up by all the other dogs around him. She thought he might have swallowed so much air and saliva that his stomach began to dilate on its long axis, making it vulnerable to twisting. "Can't we just wait and see how he does? Maybe it won't twist again." "That's what we're doing right now, waiting and watching. If his stomach flips again, I'll need you to make a quick decision. We can't let him suffer." "I need to speak with my wife," I told her. "I'll call you back." When Jenny answered her cell phone, she was on a crowded tour boat with the kids in the middle of Boston Harbor. I could hear the boat's engine chugging and the guide's voice booming through a loudspeaker in the background. We had a choppy, awkward conversation over a bad connection. Neither of us could hear the other well. I shouted to try to communicate what we were up against. She was only getting snippets. "Marley, emergency, stomach, surgery, put to sleep." There was silence on the other end. "Hello?" I said. "Are you still there?" "I'm here," Jenny said, then went quiet again. We both knew this day would come eventually. We just did not think it would be today. Not with her and the kids out of town where they couldn't even have their goodbyes. Not with me 90 minutes away in downtown Philadelphia with work commitments. By the end of the conversation, through shouts and blurts and pregnant pauses, we decided there was really no decision at all. The vet was right. Marley was fading on all fronts. It would be cruel to put him through a traumatic surgery to simply try to stave off the inevitable. We cannot ignore the high cost either. It seemed obscene, almost immoral, to spend that kind of money on an old dog at the end of his life when there were unwanted dogs put down every day for lack of a home, and more important, children not getting proper medical attention for lack of financial resources. If this was Marley's time, then it was his time, and we would see to it he went out with dignity and without suffering. We knew it was the right thing, yet neither of us was ready to lose him. An hour later, Dr. Hopkinson sounded slightly more optimistic. Marley was still holding his own, resting with an intravenous drip in his front leg. She raised his odds to 5%. "I don't want you to get your hopes up," she said. "He's a very sick dog." The next morning, the doctor sounded brighter still. "He had a good night," she said. When I called back at noon, she had removed the IV from his paw and started him on a slurry of rice and meat. "He's famished," she reported. By the next call, he was up on his feet. "I wouldn't have thought it possible yesterday, but I think you'll be able to take him home tomorrow." The following evening after work, that's just what I did. He looked terrible, weak and skeletal, his eyes milky and crusted with mucus, as if he had been to the other side of death and back, which, in a sense, I guess he had. I must have looked a little ill myself after paying the $800 bill. The doctor said, "The whole staff loves Marley. Everyone was rooting for him." I walked him out to the car, my 99-to-1 odds miracle dog, and said, "Let's get you home where you belong." From now on, he was to receive 4 small meals a day and only limited rations of water, a half cup or so in his bowl at a time. In this way, the doctor hoped, his stomach would stay calm and not bloat and twist again. That night, after I got him home and inside, I spread a sleeping bag on the floor in the family room beside him. He was not up to climbing the stairs to the bedroom, and I didn't have the heart to leave him alone and helpless. I knew he would fret all night if he was not at my side. Tomorrow the house would be loud and boisterous and full of life again, for tonight it was just the two of us, Marley and me. Lying there with him, his smelly breath in my face, I couldn't help thinking of our first night together all those years ago, after I brought him home from the breeder, a tiny puppy whimpering for his mother. I remembered how I dragged his box into the bedroom, and the way we had fallen asleep together, my arm dangling over the side of the bed to comfort him. 13 years later, here we were, still inseparable. I thought about his puppyhood and adolescence, about the shredded couches and eaten mattresses, about the wild walks along the intracoastal and the cheek-to-jowl dances with the stereo blaring. I thought about the swallowed objects and purloined paychecks and sweet moments of canine human empathy. Mostly, I thought about what a good and loyal companion he had been all these years. What a trip it had been. "You really scared me, old man," I whispered as he stretched out beside me and slid his snout beneath my arm to encourage me to keep petting him. "It's good to have you home." We fell asleep together, side by side on the floor, his rump half on my sleeping bag, my arm draped across his back. He woke me once in the night, his shoulders flinching, his paws twitching, little baby barks coming from deep in his throat, more like coughs than anything else. He was dreaming. Dreaming, I imagined, that he was young and strong again, and running like there was no tomorrow.